This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Listening to the Electric Sheep Film Show on Resonance 104.4 FM and DAB in London. I'm Alex Fitch, and the track you've just heard is Land of Giants by Dhruva Aliman, which might give you a hint about the first interview that you'll hear in this evening's show, as I'm talking to director Anders Walter about his film of the graphic novel I Kill Giants. Later in the show, I'll also be talking to the cast and crew of the new British horror film Caught, and to Bart Simpson, no not that one, but the director of a new documentary called Brasilia, Life After Design. Bart is also the producer of some terrific documentaries that have come out over the last 15 years, including The Corporation and Mobius Redux, and we'll be talking about those films as well. First though, here's my interview with Anders Walter. Anders is the Oscar-winning director of the short film Helium, which he'll be expanding into a feature over the next couple of years, and the Oscar-nominated short film 9 Meters. His first feature, I Kill Giants, is an adaptation of the graphic novel by Joe Kelly and Ken Nomura, and tells the tale of a young girl who goes out into the woods by the coast to hunt and track down giants who are endangering the local populace in a movie set in Long Island, but actually filmed in Ireland, which gives the movie a dreamlike quality. Obviously, approaching something that was initially a graphic novel, it felt very much like you brought your own voice to it. And I wondered, as someone from Denmark, whether there was some kind of interest in local legends about trolls and giants from your own folklore that you felt you were bringing to the project.
Actually not.
Okay.
Damn it. I mean, what was most surprising to me, of course, first of all, I didn't want to make my first feature in America. Mm. I really wanted to go back to Denmark after we won an Oscar for a short film. Mm. But my agent, of course, wanted me to stay. I was so scared that I wouldn't be able to do a film that felt like me and didn't have my kind of clear print on it. But then I Kill Giants came around, and it really felt like a subject matter that had a resemblance to Helium. Mm. And some of the other short films I've worked on. So I fell in love, and of course, then I went back and said, okay, let's try and finance this one. But so there are definitely some themes in there that that I personally felt that I knew something about, and I had a very specific idea about how to translate it into a feature film. The strange thing is my background is actually I've worked as an illustrator and I've done graphic novels for many years before I started directing. So you know, all the stars was positioned right, or do you say that in English?
Yes, yeah, the stars are aligning.
Exactly, that it felt like that, because with my specific background in graphic novels and then with the similar theme in I Kill Giants that was also strongly present in Helium, it just felt like a perfect project where I actually believed that I somehow could manage to keep my own voice and make it feel like a movie that I did.
Mm. Well, yes,
no trolls, sorry. No inspiration from Danish folklore or the old sagas or anything like that. Actually not.
Okay. But no, I was going to say it's almost uncanny actually looking at your short films. Helium deals with a young boy who's very ill and a doctor encouraging him to actually indulge in his fantasies to help him recover. And then with Nine Meter, you have a boy who's worried about his mother's illness and trying to crack this kind of long jump record. So even if you hadn't done an adaptation of I Kill Giants, it feels like your first feature might have been on a similar topic anyway.
I think you're so right. And also now with a couple of other projects that I'm developing, there's definitely a red thread that goes through all of them, and which is rather bizarre because I'm not quite sure why I'm so attracted to children and teenagers and how they use fantasy to deal with certain difficult things in life, and you know how they use fantasy almost as some, you know, as medicine to ease pain or to go through a period of grief. Obviously, you could think that I myself have been in such a situation when I was young, and therefore have a strong relation to that way of thinking or living. But it's also very far from the truth. I had a very nice upbringing. Nobody died. I didn't have to escape into fantasy worlds. I did that, actually, but not because I was escaping anything, just out of pure, you know, enjoyment of creating my own worlds and so on. So, of course, I just have a tremendous kind of, I wouldn't say respect, but I just think it's a magical and wonderful gift that you have when you're young, that you can actually managed to build these parallel universes and actually believe so much in them that they almost become real. I think it's rather beautiful. And it, of course, in I Kill Giants, it goes to an extent where it's almost hurting, which I also thought was interesting because she, of course, takes it so far that you start to worry for her. And so that was the new aspect of I Kill Giants. So yeah, you didn't ask me that, but I imagine you wanted to ask me if there was something in my own life.
No, not necessarily. But I mean, you know, even looking at your comics, projects like Solas, which have a young protagonist, obviously you've always been interested in trying to get into the minds of young characters. And then combining their narratives with fantasy worlds, I guess, gives a new way of looking at reality through the lens of fantasy.
Yes, I mean exactly, and that's you know a gift that I think we obviously tend to lose as we grow older. That said, of course, in my business, you still do meet a lot of crazy people who still have a very pure access to their imagination and something they. You know, if you're a director or a screenwriter or someone working and creating fiction, obviously you still have a great access to fantasy and you know how to imagine certain things. But still, you don't have that. I don't think you believe it in the same way as when you're a kid. And I think that's why it's so interesting with children, because their belief system is totally different and they make it real. It feels real for them. And I think that's why it's, I wouldn't necessarily think, I mean, let's say a 40-year-old man like myself, yes, I can come up with a fantastic world, I can do imaginary worlds, but I would never believe in someone who's 40. I would never believe them to actually live in that world, except for the pure, you know, for pure fun, or not out of a necessity to survive something. I guess we choose to do other things when we grow old. We get drunk, or we take medicine, or, you know, we try and kind of escape those heavy feelings, or we try to escape if people are in grief, or by doing all kinds of destructive things. And also, I think it's very inspiring that kids have this ability.
No, definitely. I mean, and it's interesting, you know, you're saying as a 40-year-old man, it's hard to get into the minds of children. But at the same time, obviously, as a director, when you're working with child actors, you would have to motivate them to react against presumably sometimes an empty environment where there actually isn't a monster there, but they have to pretend that there is. Was that a challenge or did it come naturally?
I worked with kids who are 6 or 7, like the boy who plays the lead in Helium, and then of course with Madison Wolf. She's a 13-year-old girl. I think she turned 14 when we shot the film last year or 2 years ago. And that's two different worlds. With a guy like Pele, who played the lead in Helium, you definitely have to kind of construct an extra parallel world just for him on his premises. So let's say, if, you know, you're shooting a scene, that scene where he walks into the airship in the end, obviously that's all shot on a green screen. And there's nothing that can motivate him. Or there you really have to create a world for him to believe in. So for instance, for that scene, I asked him, 2 days before we shot it, I kind of asked him to think about what the most important thing for him was when he was going to board the airship. So on the day when we shot it, he came up to me just before we shot it, and we had that conversation, and he said, "Yeah, okay, so I'm really looking forward to this, and because, you know, and also I want to be the first one who goes into the airship, so I'll get the best seat, and you know, I'll sit next to the window, so I get the best view as we take off." So over those 2 days before we shot it, just by asking him a couple of questions, his whole thought process started, and he managed to kind of build up his own fantasy world. So I think on the day when we shot it, he was totally there. Everything was in front of him. And that's difficult just to explain in 2 minutes if you wait and just do it on the day. So by actually building this world with him, he had all these beautiful thoughts about what he wanted and why he wanted to go on board and what his main goal was. So that's one way of working with very small kids. But Madison, she was out of this world, impressive. That was more like actually working with a grown-up. She showed up and had a very refined and thoughtful idea about how to go from A to B with the whole arc of the character. And so I would pay a lot of attention. You know, when a 13-year-old girl comes on a set and sits down with you and they start to talk about all of these wonderful things, you really want to pay attention. And she was just impressive. She had such specific notes about how to do certain things. That said, of course, you're still directing her and turning certain buttons, but just a different experience. But still, I would say even with a 13-year-old girl, of course, they have an intellect and you can have a conversation with them, but they're still kind of pure. There's something pure about them. And you see it also, typical, you know, when you do first, second, or third takes with kids or teenagers, it's just so pure that I hardly want to direct them, because you want all of their pureness before you start to put too many words into their head. So with teenagers, for me, it's more like just, you know, come on the set and then give it a shot, because I know you have some feelings and thoughts about it, and you don't want to take that away. Because as soon as you start to talk about your own ideas, you will never, ever get that first take of them doing exactly what they feel like, and it might just be the most wonderful thing you can get.
I suppose as well with this project, the actions that Madison's character undertakes, sort of carving runes into wood and leaving traps of rotting flesh hanging from lampposts, and then sort of covering leaves in strange red potions, going through all of those rituals in a way feels like an evocation of the creatures you can't see anyway. So presumably that makes it easier for her as an actress to kind of feel the magic that her character is involved in.
Yeah. No, for sure. She got totally into this world, and I really brought her into the production offices very early on to kind of introduce her to all of these wonderful things that she uses to, you know, bait buckets and all, you know, all of that, you know, her whole trap system. Made her familiar with all the stuff that I wanted to be part of her world. And of course, that's when you start to build a character together.
Mm.
By introducing all of these things, and the more things you bring in, and of course also with the wardrobe, that all helps for any actor, grown up or young and old, to get into a certain mood and a tone. Most of this film is shot on location.
Mm.
Very little is shot on a studio, and even when we were on the studio lot, and we shot the last big Titan fight, we had an exact replica of the beach where we shot in Ireland, built on the soundstage. So she was never really only acting towards a green screen. Of course, with the Titans, you had to imagine in the end. For instance, like, I insisted on doing, which is obviously very old school these days, but with the harbingers that you see in the forest, and also then later when she comes out of the comic book store and chases or escapes Sophia, and she goes into the back alley, and those strange creatures come at her and talk to her. That happens twice in the film.
Mm.
That's a physical build, and she got scared. They were really really scary on the day. They were really intimidating. So, which I prefer. I think that's what you want to do. I mean, obviously, it's difficult these days because so much is CGI.
Mm. But also the location where you were shooting the film in Ireland, it really feels like a sort of liminal space that the days you shot on, it's always quite hazy and you can never quite see the horizon. There's always mist just beyond the trees. And that gives it a dreamlike quality as well.
Yeah, I mean, I really love, it's maybe strange to say about your own film, but I'm really pleased with the look we achieved for the film, and also obviously a lot of credit my wonderful Danish DP, but we both like to shoot in natural light.
Mm.
And of course, we were also, when you're so much outside, you're also very much depending on the weather. And shooting in Ireland, I kind of expected to get a totally grey film. but we did have some beautiful sunsets and sunrises that also has a certain quality to everything. No, for me, I wanted to make, since we ended up shooting in not on Long Island, on location, and we had to move to Ireland and Belgium. And I think that helped to make it feel like this strange world of its own.
Mm.
Obviously, it does feel like some northern East Coast, New England, Long Island, kind of, because we mixed it up with some shots. We actually went to Long Island and shot some pickup, small town footage. But I wanted that kind of timeless feeling, and I wanted it to make, you know, that world should kind of be almost not a magical place, because I wanted the film to feel grounded and realistic. But I really liked the idea about that you couldn't place it exactly in one spot. It just became very universal and timeless. Of course, you can you do automatically go to certain places in the States when you see this environment, but it has a strange kind of quality to it, because the hillsides, the hills where the house is a little bit higher than you normally expect for Long Island. And so there are certain things where you do lose track on both time and location, which I like. So it turned out to work, I think, in our favor that we were forced to go to and shoot this somewhere else and not on location on Long Island.
Mm, indeed. I read in another interview that your first knowledge of the project was being given the screenplay. As it was adapted from a graphic novel, did you make a point of not reading the comic until you were well into production so that, for example, Nomura's designs wouldn't be an influence on what you wanted to achieve?
No, the story is that I got the screenplay sent from my agents, and then I fell totally madly, deeply in love, and I called them and said, okay, I'm coming back, I want to do this. And then they said, you know, it's based on a graphic novel. No, I don't know that. So I ran down to my local comic book pusher and got myself a copy, and 5 minutes later I was back and I read it. And then I was even more in love with the whole concept and called my agents again and said, okay, this is really good stuff. let's do this. So I was very inspired by Ken's artwork for quite some time. And also in the very early stages, I felt like there was something to be more directly inspired by in this. It's obviously a very expressive kind of drawing style that is used for the graphic novel. But the more that I got into it, and the more that I fell in love with the characters, this is a character piece for me. I always pitched it as a character drama and not as a big adventure film. Obviously, as you know, I for me, we have a wonderful poster, but the poster is totally bullshit in terms of what film that we're giving to people. And you feel that now on IMDb and other sites where people are giving audiences grades, you know, people are pissed off. I mean, a lot of people are totally in love with the film, but you also have a lot of people who expected a full-on action movie with a girl who was slaying giants because of the poster. But that's another story. But so I really fell in love with the characters more and more. And obviously, I fell in love with the emotional impact, the potential emotional impact of the film. So I kind of, because of that, I moved away from the more expressive, cartoonish style of the graphic novel and decided to make it much more grounded. So, but as soon as I decided to go that route, then I kind of put the graphic novel behind and I didn't really bring it back before we had finished shooting the film.
Sure. You said that your agent sent you the screenplay. After Helium won the Oscar for Best Short Film, were you inundated with offers for new projects, or did it take a while for you to find the right project to do as your first feature?
They did send me quite a lot of screenplays, but I was so stubborn. You know, I was back in Denmark developing a feature with the Danish Film Institute, and I was totally sure because I won that Oscar that they would greenlight me. But then we actually got a no in the end.
Huh.
And that was the only project that I had here in Denmark. And in Denmark, you can't really do films without the government funding. There's no private capital, really. It's too small a country. So all of a sudden, but almost in the same week, the Nikkei Giants came to me. I had probably read maybe 10 screenplays before that. All good screenplays, really solid stories and great screenwriting. But I didn't fall in love, and you have to fall in love, I think, for you to spend 2.5 years or 3 years or whatever it takes. So I had read great material before I killed Giants. But it wasn't sent to me in the sense where people were just asking me to come on and direct this. It was sent to me for me to read, and then I could, you know, maybe if I liked it, I could give my pitch. And so it took a couple of 3 or 4 months for me to convince Chris Columbus's people, 1492 Pictures, that I was the right guy for the job. So I think the Oscar did for me was that it got me on certain people's radar, and I got into the meeting rooms. But from that point on, you're basically on the same level as everybody else. You have to convince people that you have the right version for the film, and you have to convince them that you can actually attract a cast. You have to convince them that you can attract the financiers to come and give a first-time Danish feature director, you know, a lot of millions. I mean, so there's all these things that are not easy. And so it took some years. First, it took 3 or 4 months to convince them that I should get the job. And then another 2 years going around Hollywood with the producers, and then ending up in Europe before we got the money.
Gosh. Did you find that being a comic book creator helped you become a filmmaker in any respect? I mean, presumably, at the very least, the practice of drawing comics isn't dissimilar to the practice of drawing storyboards.
I felt like when I look back now, having done 4 short films and a feature, and also a feature that, you know, was a bit CGI demanding, I experienced on the set, but I experienced that also just doing short films, that I have such an easy time, not directing, but I have an easy time covering, you know, scenes with pictures and images, and I know exactly, and I think that has to do with me doing graphic novels and storyboard. I know exactly how to cover a scene, and obviously also one thing is to cover a scene, one thing, another thing is to make it interesting. But that feels so familiar to me and such a natural extension of having done what I have done over the last many years. I was always very afraid of and very concerned of my talents in terms of being able to control actors and, you know, the whole, you could say, human aspect of being on a set. Being an illustrator, and most illustrators, you would probably find them rather introvert and people who like to tell stories with pictures, for sure, but also people who decided to sit by themselves for many hours and do that with as little influenced by other people. And I was 33 before I actually managed to find the courage to go on a film set and direct actors, real actors, in my first short film. And I had that dream for many years. I think I wrote a screenplay when I was 21. So at least for 12 or 13 years, there was this kind of vibrating dream in the back of my mind that I wanted to direct one day. But I didn't have the balls to do it. But then, of course, being on a set, then I felt very comfortable with the whole aspect of storytelling with images. Still a little bit concerned about the actors. But then I soon fell very much in love with exactly that discipline of being with actors and being with children and, you know, talking with them and getting all of these wonderful gifts that you get from actors who does things that you could never imagine yourself. And they inspire you and you inspire them. And all of a sudden you sit there behind the monitor and everything explodes.
Yeah.
That I never experienced. I did that, of course, as an illustrator, but in a different way. So I was more like, why did I wait till I was 33 to actually go on a set? And now realizing that this is really something, I like this craft. It's not something to be afraid of. I really feel like it's a natural environment for me. So, yeah. I don't know why it took so long.
Well, certainly, coming from the comic book profession into directing, your peer, for want of a better word, Anders Morgenthaler, who's also Danish, used to work in comics and has done both live action and animation. Someone like the creator of Persepolis, Marjan Satrapi, who went from doing autobiographical comics to sort of crazy serial killer films. And then we might think of people like Enki Bilal, who's obviously a sci-fi comic creator and director, who did a film based on one of his own comics. Even someone like Juan Sfar, who has worked in animation, in comics, and in film. So there does seem to be increasingly a crossover between the two media, and I wonder if it's just because the film industry is becoming more visually literate, that they realise not only should we adapt comics, but maybe actually talk to people from the world of comics because they know how to express things in a visual manner.
No, I think you're right. And when you look at the movies, let's go back to the 70s. Not many movies were depending on, you know, fantastic visual storytelling. If you look at Hollywood, for instance, all of the movies that are inspired or translated from graphic novels, they're quite heavy on imagery, and they're also quite technically heavy. And the whole technical aspect is not for all directors. If we just talk about all of the Marvel movies, that really demands a certain, obviously you have to be a human kind of person to be with actors, but you also have to be very technical, and you have to know exactly what you can get away with and what you can do in post and how you can tweak and how you can do certain things. And that, I think, comes very easy for anyone who has worked as an illustrator or a graphic novel, a graphic designer, or because you used to, you know about light, you know about colors, you know about, there's so many things that you don't think maybe translate that easy to film, but it all of a sudden it's very much the same process. It's just, instead of still still images. It's just moving images, but still the process of coming up with, and also the conceptual idea about building a world from scratch. As a cartoonist, you basically built from white paper. Mm-hmm. So I do think for specific movies, I don't think this might be the case for a Susanne Bier film or Lone Scherfi, you know, talking about a Scherfi movie, talking about, you know, my other Danish colleagues who I think is more into the drama and not so much about visual storytelling. Mm. For those specific directors, I know with those two, they kind of just, they have a photographer and basically the DP is the one who visually directs the film, and they only, you know, interested in, which is also a way of making films, they're interested in the tension and the drama and the actors and the performances. And which is, I mean, by the end of the day, I'd rather see a film that has that priority, because I think any good film has to spring from great characters and great acting. I mean, with a lot of these films, like the big Marvel superhero films, they also start now to bring in people from production, you know, see production designers, people who are used to visually building concept worlds. There have been a couple of production designers who have directed, you know, major films and have that background. Ridley Scott, of course, was a production designer, art trained. So there are these people who, and yeah, you know, Ridley Scott, of course, is also a great storyboard artist. So yeah, I think it's definitely an advantage. I think coming from that background. But you could also, because you can also find people who then are, I think, too much into just the visual aspect of filmmaking, and they forget about great characters and character developing, and they don't know how to direct people on a set, and they sit and hide behind their monitor. And that, I don't necessarily think, benefits any good story. So it's a balance, of course.
Indeed. Brilliant. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, you're so Brilliant. Welcome.
Cheers.
Good talking to you.
Anders Walter's films 9 Meter and Helium are available to watch on Vimeo, and the film I Kill Giants is doing the rounds of cinemas at the moment and will be available on VOD and Shiny Disc in early May. To find out more information about the film, please go to kaleidoscopehomeentertainment.com. And if you'd like to know more about the original graphic novel of I Kill Giants, you can hear my interview with Joe Kelly, recorded at the Lakes International Comic Art Festival, as a Panel Borders podcast on our blog www.panelborders.wordpress.com. To close the first half of this evening's show and give you a flavour of the second half, here's Sambadrome by Ivo Morales and Funkin' Latter. The track you've just heard was Sambadrome by Ivo Morales and Funkin' Latter, as later in the show I'll be talking to director Bart Simpson about his film Brasilia. Before that, though, you'll hear my interview with the cast and crew of Caught, a new British horror film that comes across as Straw Dogs, written by John Wyndham. In the Q&A, which was recorded at the London Sci-Fi Film Festival, I'm talking to producer April Pearson, actor Ruben Crowe, co-writer Alex Francis, and director Jamie Patterson, who'll be the first voice you hear.
to give you a flavour of the film, here's an extract from the trailer.
School now.
Bye, bye, Mum.
We've had an idea for another story. There's something going on the moors near us. The army's up to something. It looks like they're setting up a new base. I doubt it's got anything to do with the missing woman.
Uh-oh, here they come.
Can I help you?
We've come from Kintry Moor. We have questions for you. Please, sit down.
Those people in there are seriously weird.
You are Mr. and Mrs. Costello.
Yes, of course.
Did you copulate on the moors?
Is this some kind of sick joke?
She has killed already. She will kill again. Now I will finish my question.
If we answer your questions, will you please leave our house?
We never said we would leave.
I directed the movie.
Mine's easy too. I'm April and I'm marrying him.
Yeah.
Without your involvement in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that and the dribbling.
My name's Ruben Crowe and I was playing Andrew.
I'm Alex, one of the producers and I co-wrote.
In his introduction to the film, Louis mentioned Straw Dogs, and that certainly seems to be one of the influences. But also, it seems to tap into that sort of sinister vein of English surrealism that ranges from the bed sitting room to the League of Gentlemen. Would you say those two things were influential?
I would, yeah. I haven't seen anything that you just referenced. I was like, oh God.
Who's in the zeitgeist?
Yeah, I mean, when I was brought on to do this movie, I kind of read the script and went, yeah, I just felt like I wanted to make a movie that was Stepford Wives-esque, early Carpenter, Halloween movie that was like all about tone and wasn't necessarily about gore or violence or torture porn or this sort of new wave of horror that's happened over the last 10 years, which I love and I'm a big fan of. Films like Hostel, which are wicked, and then there was Hostel 2, and then there was Hostel 3, and then there was Saw, and Saw 1, and 2, and 7, and 9, and 10, and whatever. And I felt this script would have worked if they had made it in the 70s. So kind of those references, you said, they're great. For me, it was early Carpenter, and it was Stepford Wives, and it was Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and those sort of movies that were really all about atmosphere and tone. And I was very aware when we did this movie that it was going to potentially upset people, because we're now a Netflix generation where you're used to seeing everything, and everything is put in front of you. I think you know, the end of the movie is what it is, and I'll be honest with you, we actually had a version of this movie where you saw an alien. We had a little, tiny little alien that we blew up, scary, and it walked around and everything, and it was really cool and it looked good, but at the end of the day, your imagination is going to be way more powerful than anything I can show you. If I had made this movie back in the 70s, maybe if I had shown an alien, it would have been more impactful. But nowadays, we have literally seen anything. So what's in your head of what Mr. and Mrs. Blair are underneath that skin is very different to what's in your head, and I like that. I like that we're all going to leave tonight with a different Mr. and Mrs. Blair, and whether or not, you know, that works or not, I don't know. Have I even answered your question? I don't even...
Yeah, you're in the ballpark.
Oh, I'll take that.
And so setting it in the 70s, was it a mixture of, it kind of aids the plot because they don't have mobile phones, where communicating, but also because there is that sort of sense that in the 70s there was still the possibility that there were things going on in military bases in Britain that we didn't know about?
Yeah, I mean, I'll throw it to Alex in a minute, but I mean, for me it was, I mean, the 70s was the Stranger Danger period. It was, we didn't have iPhones, we didn't have, that movie really wouldn't work if nowadays, and there was a version of it which was set present day, but we just thought, you know, come on, everyone's got a phone, everyone's got an iPad, there'd be something around for them to communicate to the outside world, so it just didn't feel like it would necessarily work and be believable. Even though it's a movie about aliens, it still didn't feel like it would be necessarily believable then. So I think, Will, I think you wore that shirt, mate. Get up on stage and show everyone that shirt that you wore, and come and, so Will was our art department on the movie, and he basically turned that house from a modern house into a 70s house and made it come to life. And we had a great costume designer, and you know, originally when we was doing the movie as well, I wanted to use a lot more zooms, you know, going in like they used to do, like Stepford Wives famous for it. But we shot this movie in 11 days as well. So we were limited, you know, April was in the makeup chair for 4 hours a day with her eye. And it was just, it was, to create that world, I feel, was difficult, but I had an amazing team around me. And yeah, they did it all. They made me look good, which is great. Thanks, Will.
Hey, Paul, were there any particular movies that inspired you for the dancing and the gurgling?
No, that was all me. Uh-huh. Oh, no, genuinely, no.
But certainly, you know, that sort of strangeness that you were evoking with your performance, being kind of unworldly and also innocent, did that just come from, like, your imagination?
No, I think, obviously, Kian and I sat down at the beginning of the shoot and went, okay, so how do we do this? How do you play an alien who hasn't felt anything, as in physical touch? Like, how heavy is everything in the world? What does it feel like when they touch humans? Do they feel heat? Do they feel like normal skin? And obviously, a lot about performing human emotion is that you can portray someone else's feelings. And when you're playing someone who doesn't do that, I mean, the great thing about this screening particularly and being here at a sci-fi festival is that you can sit amongst people who are laughing. I mean, we screened this film, the first time I ever played in front of an audience was in Portugal with subtitles. And, you know, there was an enjoyment in the room. But the fact that people were laughing at the first sight of Mr. and Mrs. Blair trying to drink tea and thinking that it was just that humans drank it to get hot. Mm. It was great, and it really felt like, you know, we'd done kind of a good job, because actually it is a bit alien, that was inverted commas, because, you know, we've never experienced anything like that before. So when we were kind of like learning how to play these people, it was literally, they're learning it at the same time. So yeah, it was really weird. It was really, I think one of the first things that Kian asked Alex, actually, or maybe it wasn't Alex, but we were definitely asking, like, how do these aliens have sex? That was like wasn't that one of the first things that he
asked?
That's
not even in the script.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we like to know our backstories as actors. But yeah, it was like, honestly, you know, playing people who got no point of reference is a really weird thing. Mm. I mean, I was just gurgling for most of it. The backstory was there.
How much of that came from the script and the directing, and how much of it was you sort of workshopping those ideas and realising what was successful and what wasn't in terms of sort of being alien?
I think the first time that I knew that I was kind of being really scary and alien-like was when one of Jeremy's friends brought their children to the set. That was not a good idea. It happened to be on the day that I was crawling around on the floor and then screaming, and that was my own scream, and the little boy that was with them cried his eyes out and had to leave and be taken away by his parents. And I don't know if Jeremy quite sort of prepped them as to what that was going to be.
He's still with the lawyers at the moment.
Sure. Should probably talk about it now. But yeah, I think that was the first time where I thought, oh, okay, this isn't just me coming to work. This is me being quite weird and freaky.
In terms of the production, obviously, if you're making a low-budget British sci-fi movie, keeping it within the environment of the house kind of makes that whole process easy, as well as, I guess, closing the curtains in case anyone walks past. But also it means that you have to think of all sorts of interesting angles to shoot the house within in order to make it interesting, in order to light it. When you only have chinks of light, you have to worry about how much is coming into the camera. So I guess it's a balance between making it interesting but also making it low budget, which must be a sort of a constant battle in a way throughout the production.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if people know the budget, but the budget was 840 million. So it's a little minor. No, it was, I think, firstly, Paul, who shot the movie, I've done three movies with him now. He's an incredible DP. He's so technical and he knows everything. He's very fast. He's absolutely wonderful. I think with this movie, we wanted it to breathe a little bit. I see a lot of horror movies that are cut kind of like a music video, like bang, 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 bang. There's like four, five, six sequences that just play out as one in this film. I think we got away with that because we had such wonderful actors. We knew Moritz, who's in here, was going to do an incredible score for the movie. And that was kind of something that we wanted to do. We didn't spend days and days planning our lighting sequences. You know, we had half a day prep with the actors. You know, some of them didn't meet till day one. It's indie filmmaking. I'm sure there's plenty of filmmakers in here who kind of know how it is. this was kind of lucky in the fact that everyone just seemed to click, everyone knew their characters, and it just seemed to work. Julius, who's also in here, did a fantastic job lighting the movie as well. It was just a good crew. It was a great crew. It wasn't a good crew, it was a great crew. And they kind of made this film something, I think, kind of special.
Mm. Well, in a way, it probably helped if the actors playing humans didn't meet the actors playing aliens until right at the start to, you know, help freak them out.
Yeah, we'll go with that one. That's why we did it. It wasn't because we couldn't afford to film on trains. That was kind of it. And it was, with a movie like this, it is hectic. You know, we're shooting 10 pages a day and it is a little bit mad, but it, like I said, every now and again, just it kind of works, and I think it works with this.
Both of the roving mics seem to have died. Well, no, I was going to say, if anyone in the audience has any questions for anyone on stage, shout. Sorry? How long did the production take from start to finish?
So we took 11 days to shoot it, and then we took 6 months on the edit and turnaround. Give or take 6 months to edit it, grade it, sound mix it, do the score, deliver it. But only 11 days to shoot.
the question was about balancing the tone, the balancing horror and comedy and sci-fi and tension.
Yeah. I think with the movie, I mean, you can say the script, but when we were directing it, it was kind of, the things that was in the script were funny. So it was kind of, and it was like April said, it was so nice to watch it with you guys who kind of appreciated that these two were weirdos. Like, these two were weird people saying weird things, and it was uncomfortable and it was funny. And with the score, I would say, was very much in control slightly of our tone, in the fact of, you know, we shot the movie the way we did, but we tried to bring that score, you might have noticed it a few times, we tried to bring it in on a scare. So the scene where April, you know, comes in, bang, bring that score in on that. We tried to do that and not do like a James Bond where it's building, 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 building. You know a scare is coming, so therefore the audience is expecting. We tried to get rid of that. And I think that, you know, you've got to let anything that horrific happens, you've got to have those moments to breathe. I think it's important. If it's all gung-ho 24/7 for 90 minutes, I think you can't, what are you saying with that movie? I think, you know, these are real people and they're trying to deal with the situation. And I think allowing it to breathe. I would say the score is definitely something that played a big part in the tone of our overall movie.
In the middle.
It is obviously it's scripted, but it's really powerful. It's just these, you know, these weird people hadn't heard music before. Mm. And to hear a piece of music like that, it has an effect on all of us, human or non-human. Mm.
Oh. it is annoying to have to go, "You caught," as opposed to, "What did you catch in that photo you took?" But like everyone's saying, it totally adds to the kind of weirdness of them. And even when I did have four lines, they were all kind of, you know, very, very short, very sort of learnt dialogue that they've kind of spent a while watching humans learning and basically kind of try and copy them, and like you can see in the kind of physical aspect of our performances, we're very much kind of copying them and in what they do. And I don't really have to learn anything, so didn't make it that difficult.
You know,
can I just really quickly say that red room,
yeah,
Julius, we call that the grief hole. Yeah, I mean, 3 days in there, 4 days, how many was it? A lot of days. I didn't even have to go in. But these guys were in that red room for a long, long time. And it was a very small space. And it was a decision that Paul made, the DP, quite early on in the shoot. He went, "Wouldn't it be great if all of the stuff in this room was red?"
So that was, that whole stuff was just lit by a single red bulb as well. I mean, I think it was when, when you shoot moving 11, that it's hard, you can't spend too much time with lighting.
No,
that's kind of,
you've just got to get on with it.
Otherwise, you've got half of it. You know, and I've always said I'd rather have a whole movie that was brilliant. Thanks. That was almost like 80% great than half a movie that just didn't go anywhere. What can you do with half a movie? So, we tried to keep it as simple as possible. But that whole red room grief hole, whatever, was just literally just flick that on. Let's go, and it worked for us that time.
Okay.
And a quick third question. Mrs. Blair's right eye. Did that take a lot of work to do? The
Yeah.
Mrs. Blair's right eye. No, that was an amazing special effects makeup artist called Dan Martin, who, yes, who fed, well, it was an airbag fitted to my eye, which was then stuck with all kinds of silicone glues, and then it was a prosthetic mold of my face, so they did a silicone, like, normal life cast of my whole head, and then made a prosthetic fit to go over the airbag, which was then fit into a tube behind my ear, went all the way down through my costume, out into the side of the shot that you can't see, and there's Dan off screen, literally pumping a bag full of air. So in the cut that doesn't have any sound and that's completely like non-graded and non-scored, you can literally hear as the air goes in and out of the prosthetic eye. So yeah, I think that took, I was in makeup for maybe 4 hours, so not too long. It would have been if it was both eyes. But yeah, he was amazing. He's very talented. I've worked with him many, many times now. And he loves doing stuff like that. Basically, you say to him, Dan, what do you fancy doing next? He's like, ooh, pulsating eye. So yeah, did it.
There's one at the back.
An Alexa. So we've shot the last three movies.
I mean, you can hold it.
Yeah, sure. it was an Alexa Mini. We shot the movie on. We actually, and for the first time ever, I don't know if there's Alexa people in here, but our Alexa, we bought a brand new Alexa for this film, and it broke on day one. Literally just stopped working. Never happens, apparently. Did. But they were great. They delivered a new one day two. But yeah, we shot on an Alexa.
What sort of format's that? So I'm not a camera expert.
You get that one, Jeremy.
It's a very good camera.
Very good camera. Shot Skyfall on that.
No,
let's just name films that were shot on it. Yeah, make it sound good.
No, just because it sort of had the quality of 16mm, which again sort of evokes some of those 70s, low budget movies.
Yeah.
All in the grade. Yeah. So originally there was a whole sequence in this movie where Mr. and Mrs. Blair went to a shop to buy a bar of fudge and dropped the fudge, and there was a whole scene outside of it. We just couldn't afford to do it. So we just cut it and said, oh, it's the shop down the road. There we go.
That older demographic. Are you guys, do you have a presence on Facebook, Twitter, if people have more questions that they want to...
Yeah, we're at...
Don't look at me.
What are you, Ruben?
I'm in the 70s, so...
brilliant.
Caught the movie.
That's the one.
There it is, Caught the movie. Yeah, cool. So we are, and thank you everyone for coming and staying for the Q&A as well. Like, really appreciate it.
Caught, directed by Jamie Patterson, is available now on video demand services, including Vudu, VUDU.com, where the film can be rented for $7, or you can download a digital copy to keep for $10 in standard def or $13 in high definition. The Q&A was recorded at Sci-Fi London, London's international science fiction and fantastic film festival, which this year begins on Tuesday the 1st of May at the Stratford Picture House in East London. UK premieres include Defective, Chimera, Nothing Really Happens, Cygnus, The Outer Wild and The Gateway. There's a reunion of the MST3K Adlibbers for a special screening of Ed Wood's Glen or Glenda, and the festival ends with a special Frankenstein film marathon on Monday the 7th of May. You can find more info about Sci-Fi London by going to sci-fi-london.com. In tonight's final interview, I'm talking to director and producer Bart Simpson, who has a number of short films and feature-length documentaries under his belt, including producing The Corporation and Mobius Redux, a documentary about the legendary French comic creator, and most recently he's also directed the documentary Brasilia, Life After Design. In this feature, Bart looks at how the architect Oscar Niemeyer's vision for a utopian Brazilian city in the mid-20th century hasn't led to an environment that is quite as utopian for the various people who live and commute in and out of the city while trying to earn a living. The movie combines fantastic views of the cityscape along with insight into the lives of various people who work and live in the city, and as such presents a fantastic slice of life of a part of the world that isn't that well known. Ahead of its screening as part of this year's East End Film Festival, I spoke to Bart Simpson about the film Brasilia, as well as his various other projects as producer.
I guess I first came across your work when The Corporation was released, and it's nice to be able...
Yes.
Yeah, I hadn't realised until I looked you up that you'd also directed this movie as well, so it's...
Yes, it's interesting. It's almost, God, how many years has it been for The Corp now? I think it's been...
15?
We released it, about that, yeah, it was like 2004 that the technical release was, so... Mm. It's a long time, but good old days.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting looking, I mean, this is your first film as director, but looking at your back catalogue as a producer, the kind of documentaries that you've produced have been very varied in subject. The Corporation, obviously, Mobius Redux, which, you know, tells the story of France's most famous comic book illustrator, Bananas, all about how poor farmers have to fight against, you know, the machinations of big companies. So the kind of stories you tell, it's almost like these are stories that are somewhat known, but then you're delving into them deeper so that people can find out more about the subjects that you're looking at.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, you're probably right. It's funny because I don't really think about a plan beforehand. I'm a bit maybe spastic in terms of what interests me. So maybe in another 10 or 20 years, I'll look back and say, what the hell happened? But in the meantime, it's been a fun ride.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, looking at the kind of roles that you've had on films before you became a producer, you've worked in the sound department, you've been a production manager. Was it always your aim, though, to direct and produce?
Yeah, I sort of fell into directing fell into producing after film school. I was going to quit film school back in the late 90s. I wrote this really bad sci-fi film that was just, I mean, it was horrible. I mean, I had this moment of crisis with my prof, who happened to be a documentary filmmaker.
Mm.
And he said, well, if you were to make a documentary, what would it be? And I thought of my Uncle Max, who was a linguist and church chamber choir composer, who also believed very passionately that the Old Testament was a recording of UFO sightings. So he wrote for the Flying Saucer Review in London, and had a very interesting career in Latin America just after the war in the diplomatic corps. So basically, it was a short film about how he maybe came to terms with being a devout Christian, but also very strong believer in alien life and how that kind of worked for him. So after that, I kind of caught the documentary bug and found myself in a very, very supportive community and wanted to learn the business, and I just got this great opportunity with Mark, my former partner on the Corporation documentary, and we did a couple films together, and then the train just kept rolling in that area. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I tend to just get involved in projects that take a long time, and that can be fulfilling at the end of it, but in the middle, it's a real grind. And I think I have to get better at just getting faster, to be perfectly honest, because it's like, it's the long hauls are, you've only got so many of those in you. You know what I mean? I guess I always imagined that I'd be, I think moving forward, I still love parts of producing. I mean, I don't want to ever get rid of it, especially when you find a good, international co-producing partner like Amara at Aconite Productions in Glasgow. But I think that, there's got to be a happy balance between the both for me.
Mm, indeed. And in terms of being a producer and your relationship with the director who's making the movie, how does that work? Mm-hmm. Does it vary enormously from project to project?
Sure, it depends. I mean, sometimes, like for the Mobius Redux film, I came in pretty late in the game. I'm a big fan of Jean Giraud's work, and I saw a German team pitch it at Hot Docs, really wanted to get involved. So I came in on the back end of it. We helped with the editing and the post production. Other times, like with The Corp or with the Bananas films, it was right at the start and just trying to bounce ideas back and forth and going on research shoots and trying to figure out what the frame of the whole thing was, you know, especially in the case of the Bananas films. And then, you know, once the machine is set up, then just making sure that the story is going to be told the way that the director intends it to be told. And also being, you know, the devil's advocate much of the time.
In terms of agreeing and disagreeing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, yeah,
I've been in a band for about 20 years, and I think that's where I learned most of my collaborative and argumentative skills.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But certainly a film like The Corporation, that really felt like it was taking documentary cinema in a new direction. I mean, I dare say there had been other examples before that, but the mixture of infographics, of talking heads, of archive footage that's just being used kind of as illustrative rather than actually showing you what's happening, that seemed a really potent mix. And I don't recall seeing it in a documentary before being quite as well used or being perhaps such a popular end product.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Well, I think it's funny because for me, the basis of that film, what Mark and Joel were doing, Jennifer were doing, was very... It's classical in a sense because it's very much an essay film. There's a point of view and an argument that's being made in a way that, you know, and basically everything is in support of that argument. And I think that the good news or the thing about that film, I think that makes it work so much is that it's deceptively simple. You know what I mean? Like there's a simplicity, but a real depth, as you say, and the sort of connections that can be made with the archive and what, you know, the interviews that are happening. There's a real debate during the whole filming process. I don't know if you remember, but we used a green screen to do a lot of our interviews, and we kind of ripped off the Errol Morris technique of, you know, basically interview subjects speaking directly to camera. And there was a big debate about what's going to be behind them, what's going to be behind the interview subjects. Mark experimented with a couple of things, but ultimately settled on just a simple black background. So it, for one thing, I think it unifies the speakers in a way, so you're not really engaging in the same way maybe as you know, assumptions of class and position and all that kind of stuff, but also just aesthetically I think it kind of really focuses the audience on what's being said.
And I suppose looking at your career as a producer, in a way Mobius seems the outlier, because all of the other films that you've made have been sort of been looking at downtrodden people, whether they've been abused by corporations or the people in Brasilia who are sort of eking out a living, but it's fairly precarious. While Mobius, actually everyone involved is quite successful.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think that film, like I say, it's I came to it as a fan of his work, and I think that I don't know. There's something about the way that he saw the future still that I think might have some tie-in to the rest of what I'm interested in. You know, especially that his work was heavily borrowed for Blade Runner and all that kind of dystopian kind of futuristic vision. You know, at the same time, I think that we just got the rights. I'm going to be directing a new film now on Harvey Kurtzman, the founder of Mad, you know, among other things, of course. So, you know, it's funny because I think that you're right. When I look back and see what kind of fuels me in terms of, you know, putting the spotlight on places that interest me for one, and hopefully interest other people, you know, create a dialogue in a way that maybe, you know, we don't see in the mainstream too much. I'm still interested in the kind of, you know, weirdos and art geeks and all that kind of stuff. That's really where I live too. So it's like a bit of a line. I mean, I don't know where I cross it, but yeah, what can you say?
Yeah. Well, and in a way, I guess, Brasilia, Life After Design is almost the flip side of a film like Mobius, as it's an architect who had a utopian vision, who actually builds a place, you know, and expects that it will perhaps be inhabited by people who have a wonderful life. But then when you come to it many decades later, the people that you've chosen, at the very least, are only just about eking out an existence in this somewhat dystopian landscape.
Yeah, very much so. I think that the thing that interested me about it is that when I first started, I first went to Brasilia by accident in 2004, and it was for a film festival down there where we were showing The Corporation. And I had this, you know, naive vision of what Brazil was, you know, football and, you know, Amazon and favelas and samba music and all that kind of stuff, only to arrive in Brasilia and realize it was really none of that, at least in the way that we know it. So, you know, it was like East Berlin dropped in the middle of the desert. And I started to, you know, think, well, if I'm going to direct a film one day that is kind of going to require a long time and, you know, I can learn something about a culture and, you know, meet some very interesting people, then this might be it. So I started in 2010 by interviewing Niemeyer before he died. He was 102 at the time. And it was one of the last interviews he ever did, I think. And basically, we got the rights to do two 8-hour interviews. But by the time I got down there, he was too sick. So I ended up getting a grand total of about 5 or 6 questions. Wow. That I kind of sort of eked out to 8. And that part is in the last part of the film. And what he said, I don't want to spoil it, but what he said kind of switched my angle on it. And, you know, I didn't know if I was doing the interview for research or for, you know, really having him have a real role in it. But there have been a lot of films about the history of Brasilia, you know, Niemeyer, Lúcio Costello, that kind of stuff. And not a lot about the impact of their work on the people who have to live in it. So my hope is that I was going to try and come up with a way to do a ground up urban planning film, like something that would, where you might feel like you're part of the city for a little while. And it's a totally different type of film for me, but, you know, it was a lot of experimentation and meeting some amazing people and, you know, having those friendships kind of helped me lead to other areas.
Well, I guess it's the vision of Brasilia that he had when he was creating the city is based on that whole sort of trickle-down neoliberal idea that if you build something fantastic, if you create, you know, sort of amazing, well-funded amenities, then that will somehow trickle down to the poor people and they will all have a wonderful life. But as you show, that hasn't happened much at all. They're just sort of selling cheap memorabilia and busing in from the outskirts for up to hours, you know.
Yeah. In a way, I mean, I think it's more that, you know, Niemeyer was a communist. He came in at a time just after a very brutal dictatorship, or Kubitschek did, who was the president at the time, and he tapped Niemeyer to do the work along with Lúcio Costa. And their hope was that, you know, this is a way to break away from the dictatorial and colonial past, and, you know, let's create an environment that would produce a new Brazilian citizen. So they wanted to make it as easy for people to live. So that's separating work, home, and leisure into different sectors of the city. Their hope was that there would be, you know, all classes would live together, and eventually there would be no classes as we know them. And so the city kind of started out with that kind of hopeful, for them, kind of unified vision. But a couple other things happened. I mean, another dictatorship came in, the design got kind of thwarted, and ultimately people kind of chose a different way of life. So when I talked to Niemeyer, he said that Brasilia wasn't his best work, which kind of shocked me at the time because, you know, I mean, being given carte blanche to build a city from scratch for him and Lúcio Costa was, I mean, probably any architect and urban planner's dream. But for him, I think what it was that as somebody who was very strong in his political ideology, he was disappointed that people didn't follow the path that he was hoping they would follow. So that's kind of where the kind of disconnect comes in for me, because, you know, and ironically, when the next dictatorship came in, they found it was very easy to, you know, control things and control the population because the city itself was, you know, really micromanaged in that kind of way, that kind of top down way.
So
Brasilia to me became about how do you resist it? How do you live in those restrictions? And, you know, the people in their 20s and early 30s in particular who grew up in a democracy and, you know, want to be connected with the world and that kind of thing, or trying to find ways to humanize it. So that's kind of the, you know, how do you be human in a city that's ultimately kind of inhuman? You know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting how so many architects, certainly in the mid 20th century, had this utopian vision that if they built these cities that look beautiful on paper, that somehow that would lead to enriching lives. And, you know, in the UK, we had lots of what are now called brutalist housing estates.
Yes, right.
You know, that were conceived of as communities in the sky, but then 30, 40 years later, are just crime ridden, you know, covered in grime and anything but a nice place to live.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot of connectivity with that kind of stuff. And, you know, then you've also got planned cities like in India and Chandigarh and also Canberra and Australia, all that kind of thing. And there's, you know, even up in Scotland, there were some of the projects up there, I think, really speak to what you were talking about. So I don't know. It's like the danger of best laid plans. You know what I mean? The hope was that something would turn out, but then the combination of people and conditions just show that you really can't plan maybe that tightly and expect it to live on forever. I think people are very curious creatures, and they end up making decisions that nobody can really predict.
Indeed.
And that's kind of the issue.
Mm. In terms of...
Yeah, the beauty of it, really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Mm. The people whose lives that you do depict in the movie, you know, who you follow on a variety of different days and different conditions, how did you find them to start off with?
Okay, well, one of the guys we found who kind of ended up being a breakout character for us was Williams, the vendor salesman. Mm. We were outside. The hope was when I first came in to do the film, I was thinking of kind of, you know, representing these different sections, work, home, and leisure, you know, traffic with different people in the group. So I sort of had that in the back of my mind. And I realized I was becoming as dictatorial as the design team for the city. So I just decided to let that filter and flow through and just really find people who were trying to find ways to connect and to make meaningful connections in the city that's built to divide. Mm. So basically with Williams, he's from Rio. So he's kind of got this different sensibility and different energy to a lot of other people in the city. And I also wanted somebody to be able to speak about the buildings from a ground up kind of perspective. So somebody who could, you know, explain to somebody on screen, but also the audience, like what the cathedral is or what the Plaza of Three Powers is, that kind of idea, in a very kind of, you know, roots kind of ground way. And then his story, which I don't want to give away, but it really kind of took us in a completely different direction, which I think is great.
Mm.
Because you don't want to end up with stereotypical people or present them in stereotypical ways. The hope was that you can kind of find the depth, the time to have the depth in everything. But at the same time, I think it's tricky because it's not a character-driven film per se. Like it's like the city is the main character of the film. So there are some people that you see in the film, like Williams, who have a very clear, you know, path and arc that kind of unfolds. Which has to do with this connecting energy and other people where things happen too, but you don't really get as close to them. So Williams, we found by accident when we were filming the cathedral. We just wanted to get some B-roll of buildings because that's what you have to do in that city. It's so incredible, a lot of the buildings. Nancy, my co-writer, heard somebody yelling behind us and said, "Hey, Bard, why don't we go talk to this guy, you know, see if he wants to participate." And that's how we found him. Mm-hmm. Other people we just found through, you know, meeting friends. And I lived there off and on. I think I lived there for about a year and a half about a 5-year period.
Hmm.
And, you know, just spending a lot of time going to parties and, you know, I had my own little old man bar and my gym and all that kind of stuff. And just trying to get into a routine where I would meet people and get to talk about things and see what might happen.
Mm. Well, if anything, I mean, the way that you structure the film does feel like the experience of perhaps a flaneur in a city, that someone who's wandering around, who goes to the tourist area, perhaps buys a souvenir, catches a bus, goes to a festival, hangs out with some people at the festival. So in a way, it almost feels like some sort of, you know, accidental journey and the people you might meet on that trip.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's probably true. That's probably very true.
Mm.
Yeah.
So this the film is showing in a festival in London. Presumably, it's had similar screenings around the world. What's the feedback been like so far?
It's been pretty good. I mean, we've had, I think the first thing that we get back is that it's a film that people don't generally expect because for the people who know about Brasilia, and there's a few passionate people who know about Brasilia, but most people don't know what Brasilia is. There's an anticipation that it's going to be something like presented in a way they might have seen before. So more of a pure historical film or a film with, architects talking about what, you know, you know, how the city's laid out in particular and all the mathematical elements of that. But the hope in the edit room was that we would, you know, have information as simple as possible and just as bare minimum information as possible so that it would orient people. But if they want to find out more details, they can, you know, go online and that kind of stuff. Because the important thing was to, like I say, experience what it might have been to live there for a while. Mm-hmm. And that is the feedback that we're getting from people, which is nice. Great. That it feels like they've visited the city or they've seen a part of, they've seen something you didn't expect, that kind of idea.
Mm. Yeah. Cool. Okay, thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Brasilia, Life After Design, directed by Bart Simpson, is showing at this year's East End Film Festival, which began on the 11th of April and continues until the 29th of April at various venues across London. Other movies include The Bromley Boys, showing at the Genesis Cinema on the 21st of April, the new thriller from Fatih Akin, In the Fade, with Diane Kruger, which is showing on the 21st of April at the Curzon Allgate, and of course Brasilia, Life After Design, showing on the 26th of April at Rich Mix on Bethnal Green Road. The festival concludes on the 28th and 29th of April with screenings at the Castle Cinema on Brooksby Walk in E9, including a documentary on Wax Trax Records and the erotic animated film 1001 Nights. For more information about all East End Film Festival showings, please go to eastendfilmfestival.com. And a couple of Bart Simpson's films as producer, Mobius Redux, screened on the BBC as In Search of Mobius, and The Corporation, are available to watch in standard def on YouTube. The Electric Sheep Film Show was recorded, edited, and introduced by Alex Fitch, and is a Panel Borders production. You can find all previous episodes at electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/events. And to play out this evening's show, here's another visit to Brazil with the track Waters of March by David Byrne and Marissa Monte. Thanks for listening.
A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. It's a little alone, it's a sliver of glass. It's a life, it's the sun, it is night, it is death. It's a trap, it's a gun.
É peroba do campo, é o nó da madeira. Canga, candeia, é Matita Pereira. É madeira de vento, tombo da ribanceira. É o mistério profundo, é o queira ou não queira. É o vento ventando, é o fim da ladeira. É a vida, é o vão, festa da cumbieira. É a chuva chovendo, é conversa ribeira. Das águas de março, é o fim da canseira.
The fruit, the ground, the flesh and the bone.
Passarinho na mão, pedra de atiradeira. É uma ave no céu, é uma ave no chão. É o regato, é uma fonte, é um pedaço de pão. É o fundo do poço, é o fim do caminho. No rosto, desgosto, é um pouco sozinho.
A spear, spike, point, a nail, a drip, a drop, the end of the tail.
É um peixe, é um gesto, é uma prata brilhando. É a luz da manhã, é o tijolo chegando.
A mile,
é o dia,
a push, a bump. Girl, it's a rhyme, it's a hope, it's the mark.
É o projeto da casa, é o corpo na cama. É o carro enguiçado, é a lama, é a lama.
Drift,
punch, flight, run, rest.
Quit, promise of spring. And riverbanks talk of the waters of March. It's the promise of life, it's the joy in your heart.
It's a life, it's the sun. É a noite, é a morte. É...
I'll strain, it's the joy in your heart.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.